folks, and welcome to another episode of IT Life Radio, the show for you, the IT pro, the technologist, the futurist, and the maker. Every other Wednesday, we bring you experts on topics important to your life, your IT life. I'm your host, Dave Wagner, and today we're talking virtual reality and collaboration. You probably don't think of those two things together yet, and that's because they really don't work that well together yet. But if there is a man who can help workplaces learn to use visual technology like VR for collaboration, it is our guest, John Underkoffler. They call him the real Tony Stark, and there's a reason. If there's a cool interface in a movie you've seen, chances are John has helped design it. John is CEO of Oblong Industries, developer of the G-Speak spatial operating environment and the mezzanine conferencing and collaboration system in use at firms from Boeing to Beats Music. Oblong's technology trajectory is built on 15 years of foundational work at the MIT Media Lab, where John was responsible for innovations in real-time computer graphics, large-scale visualization techniques, and the I.O. bulb and luminous room systems. He has been the science advisor to films including Minority Report, The Hulk, directed by Ang Lee, Aeon Flux, Stranger Than Fiction, and Iron Man. John also serves as adjunct professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, on the boards of the 5D Conference, the University Art Museum Board at CSULB, the Sequoia School, and the E14 Fund, and on MIT's Visiting Committee. He's also the winner of the 2015 Cooper Hewitt National Design Award for Interaction Design. Welcome, John. That's quite a resume.
Very glad to be here with you today, Dave, wherever here is, and I'm horrified you had to read that. I'm really, really sorry.
No problem. I think it helps our audience realize just exactly how much of a ninja they're really talking to.
Oh, dear.
So my listeners probably want to know when they get their own Jarvis and Iron Man suit to go with it, but before we go there, I just want to start with a real basic question.
Sure.
What's wrong with workplace collaboration today?
That's a good one. To start a little bit gently, and then we'll get a lot more rambunctious, I suspect, if you let it go that way.
We'll definitely
digital
get
tools for work.
If you want.
No, good. So, from my point of view, at least, and that's all I can really express. Digital tools for workplace collaboration so far have been extremely anemic. They don't come anywhere close to providing the kind of real-time features and modalities that human beings who aren't infested with digital technology enjoy when they collaborate. So that's sort of a capsule summary. And then the second problem is really one of vocabulary. I think we sort of need to define our terms. So what do we mean by collaboration? As recently as 5 years ago, collaboration was a bad word when it was connected to technology and workplace products, because it had been attached to previous technological products that had really not worked. And so when we started working on Mezzanine and Oblong, we didn't dare use the word. Now the word is back, and it's back in force, but people mean really radically different things by it. So people call file syncing and file sharing services collaboration. That's not what I mean when I say collaboration. You know, that's like me working on a big stack of legal documents and then dumping a box, you know, in front of your door at home at 11 p.m. and then you get up in the morning and work on it. That doesn't feel real time enough to qualify as collaboration. But people mean a whole spectrum of things by it. So what I'm principally interested in is, again, the kind of human collaboration that humans engage in left to their own devices when computers aren't in the way, when devices aren't in the way, and when what you've got is big pieces of paper, walls that you can tack things up to, eye contact, you know, human gesture, whiteboards, all that great stuff that we get for free and that we know how to do because it's part of the social contract that's really inbuilt, that's evolved into us.
Okay, so that's interesting to me. I think you're right. I think that we don't really collaborate through technology the way you're talking about when we get into a room. And that makes a lot of sense to me. Now, the other half of this that I promised in our preview for this is a little discussion about virtual reality. How does virtual reality come into collaboration? Is this going to be our big savior? Are we all going to strap on the helmets and get into some sort of big, sort of almost like a holodeck experience and collaborate in a brand new way? Is that the future?
You know, it's not clear. People have suggested that that kind of thing would be possible. I think we can start to sort of stake out positions along a continuum for different kinds of display and interaction devices, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I want to recognize that the inherent problem with applying VR ideas to collaboration is that you've basically, you know, you've put a bucket over your head, you've wiped out regular reality, and replaced it with something quite possibly fantastic, but built from scratch. So there too, all of the kind of human, biological, visual cues that we use when we're working with other people, and that we get for free when it's just regular life, have gone away. So if we want to talk about collaboration in a VR space, then we have to literally build it from the ground up. There's no maps to those territories, as it were.
Right. So what I'm hearing from you basically is that we've got these two bad ends, right? We have the completely uncollaborative, unvisual environment of old technology, and then we have the sort of sounds really cool but actually takes away touch and smell and taste and real world of this high-end technology that everybody's interested in, and that somewhere in the middle is something really cool.
I think that's right. Make no mistake, I don't want to demean VR. It's really, really exciting. I'd love to start, you know, designing for it. But we can pinpoint the current problem, which is that people are super excited about VR. Let's not forget that it's 35 or 40 years old, right? You can talk to Scott Fisher and Jaron Lanier, and they were doing this stuff a long, long time ago. But it's back. The technology has caught up so that it sort of makes sense. You can do it on a smartphone now if you need to, and a bunch of folded cardboard, et cetera, et cetera. But what no one is doing is discussing or building UI for virtual reality. Not yet. And that seems like a big pitfall, a big mistake, to not identify that as the single most important thing we can do if we want this new platform, if we want this new capability, if we want this new modality to take off. Because otherwise, you're basically just in a wraparound movie theater, right?
Exactly. Like, when I've tested VR, I've been asked to do one of two things. Either sit in a really comfy chair with really nice speakers and watch something, or I've been asked to stand in a very safe place where I won't accidentally fall over anything and
sort of
move around a little bit for some sort of gaming experience. But realistically, if I tried to do that in my living room, I'd kick the dog or I'd trip over the coffee table.
I mean, I think there's a really exciting opportunity in the legal world to start setting up legal defense funds for when we need to start suing each other over VR-related accidents. You fall down.
Right.
Or you kick the dog.
We should all do. We should become virtual reality lawyers right now. We can set up our offices, and people can only visit us through a VR helmet.
I'm in. Good. I'm sure we'll have funding from Sand Hill Road later this afternoon. the promise is enormous, and there are no fundamental roadblocks. It's just that we're not building the most important stuff yet, and we need to get to that. I think, you know, something that's really interesting to think about is to start building universal UIs, a UI that is conversant whether you're in VR or whether you're in AR and it's a kind of mixed reality thing, or whether you're in RR, real reality, which is kind of where Oblong has planted its flag. So the idea that you might have a single lingua franca that lets you meaningfully interact in every one of those modalities, and that's the spectrum I promised earlier, that's kind of a really thrilling design opportunity, I think.
Right. Well, I can't help but point out that Windows 10 released today, and I'm sure that the folks at Microsoft think that they're the universal operating system and user experience. So with that in mind...
Realists would like to be that.
Yes. where are we falling short on UI? How is UI getting in the way of real collaboration?
Well, if we return to basics, there hasn't been serious work, and therefore there hasn't been much forward progress at all on UI in 30 years. The big moment, the big Cambrian explosion, well, and that's the wrong term too. The big explosion was the GUI, and it came to commercial reality first in the form of the Macintosh and proliferated outward, and we got Windows and, you know, Linux desktops and all the rest of it. And that idea was profound. But now that idea is 30 years old, and we're using that same set of mechanisms to interact with vastly more capable machines that, you know, can perform incredible feats of graphics and sound, but not just that, they've got networks, and so they talk to each other, they talk to the power of the cloud, whatever sort of moist set of condensation that thing is. And yet we're still kind of grunting and clicking, literally clicking, to access that stuff. So it puts us as humans at a pretty substantial disadvantage, I think. Whereas, in fact, it's possible to build a radically more capable UI, which is one of the things that that designing fictional interfaces for film or speculative fiction or whatever gives you a chance to try out. You know, what would it look like? What would it feel like if you had a much higher bandwidth connection between you as the entity with volition and a desire to synthesize or analyze or whatever it is, and the machine, which should be, you know, should be taking its marching orders from you, but if you can't express yourself, it can't do that.
Right. Well, that gets us, I think, to asking, you know, about the elephant in the room, which is some of the interfaces you've designed in the movies, Iron Man and Minority Report. And I noticed there are two things that it seems like all of the fictional interfaces you design seem to have in common. One seems to be they use a lot more voice than I think current operating systems use. And the other tends to be that they aren't tethered to a computer. They tend to float in the air, or they tend to be holograms, for lack of a better word, yet they're tangible. They're something that you can touch, you can move.
Yeah.
First of all, is that a fair thing to say? And second of all, how do you think, if that is, those two things are going to interact with sort of our real-world interfaces in the next couple of years?
So to your first question first, those observations are partially accurate. They're accurate in the case of some of the fictional UIs that I've been involved with, and not others. But let's take it apart. Let's unfold the thing. If we want to talk about voice, voice was important in Iron Man, especially when Tony's in the suit, because if you think about it, he's busy flying around. The only way he can interact with with all the sort of heads-up graphics and with the back-end Jarvis AI is through voice and his gaze, his eye direction. That's all he's got, right? No time to clutch a mouse or wave gesturally in the air, which he does
right when
he's in his lab, right?
Right.
So that's the importance of voice there. We might ask, why haven't we seen voice interface technology make more progress in the real world than we have? And I think there's a couple of things. One, the foundational technology has only recently gotten over the threshold, I think, to where it's good enough. You can actually talk to your bank or whatever horrifying, you know, automated service exists on the other end of the phone line, and it'll actually understand you most of the time now. So that's an important thing. But there's a second observation that I haven't seen people talking about or writing about much yet, which is that, to my way of thinking, voice and audio exists substantially in the wrong realm, in the wrong dimension for what we usually want computers to help us do. It exists in the frequency, in the space of frequency and over time. But human language is really, really bad for talking about space, for talking about spatial relationships, and especially for describing precise locations. And when you've got a screen full of pixels, you know what? How are you gonna move the cursor around, as it were? Now, I mean,
right,
it's
yeah.
reductive
go,
and silly to
left,
think that you would have a
pixels.
Cursor necessarily. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Right.
So I think that's been an impediment, but that's not to say that we couldn't build a really, really fiery good UI that exists purely in the audio domain, and that too seems like a really juicy design opportunity. I think we've been thinking about it wrong. So that,
right.
That's the voice piece. Then the sort of disconnected thing is generally true in the sense that I'm really interested in building user interfaces where the human and the part of the human that's involved in the UI isn't necessarily in intimate contact with the device. So that's gesture, basically, or other kinds of spatial UI where you've stepped back from lots of big pixels, screens all over the place, and by stepping back, you can now point at any one of those screens. So if you compare that to how we think about UI today, if you're on your laptop, you've got a mouse or a trackpad, it's nonsensical to say, well, you know, you can't get the cursor off the side off the side of the display, right?
It
stops at the physical boundary, which seems, on the one hand, intuitive and logical, but then if you think about it, it's actually an artificial constraint. So the middle of the room is the place you can stand and literally access all of the pixels by pointing. You know, pointing is a pretty fantastic human gesture. It's spatial. It's social. You point for the benefit mainly of other people because you know that they can look at your hand and automatically do vector math in their heads and know what you're pointing at. And so when you teach the machine to understand that, there's now a logical connection between, you know, the human in space and the pixels in space. But the most important result of that proposition is that now you've got a centralized universal UI that can talk to more than one screen, talk to more than one device. Right.
Right.
You can't, you have to lift your thumb off of your smartphone if you want to type on your laptop or if you want to pick up your tablet. Those are three different UIs because the UI doesn't think broadly enough. It's not open-minded enough about what it might need to do. So there's this weird constraint that the UI is physically connected to the device and the pixels that it serves. I'm just saying decouple those two pieces, free it up,
right,
and then, you know, give the human the most capable possible UI available.
Right. So that's interesting. So when I see, you know, Tony Stark manipulating a hologram floating in the air, it's actually not about decoupling the information from the screen. It's actually about decoupling Tony Stark from the computer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
well,
he can move around. He can. Yeah, it is. It is, because I think
that's a real shift in thinking.
I think that may be the case. Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's so what that means is that we can take a normal wall of computer screens like we have today, and if we can teach them to understand your gestures, we don't need the hologram. What we need is the gestures. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. And if someone invents a real-world, you know, real-time holographic display medium down the road, which we will eventually, but it's really hard, then that same set of gestural commands or spatial commands or the same UI will work absolutely well with that additional display medium. And it'll allow you to interoperate between the flat displays on the wall and the floating, you know, autostereoscopic image in the room. And that's what we're really getting at.
Okay. Well, that's first of all, that's awesome. Thank you, because I think that really clarifies something for me in a different way of thinking. More importantly, I think it gets us back to the original question, which is how can we collaborate better? And it sounds to me like what you're talking about here is creating a three-dimensional space for collaboration, where in the past we've only had two dimensions. That if people
Bingo.
Can get up and move around in a room and focus on 20 screens and all of them understand their gestures and can follow the people in the room, we're talking about real-life three-dimensional collaboration. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that collaboration is, as you know, is no less rich than the collaboration you would have available with, you know, pencil and paper and humans and whiteboards and, you know, thumbtacks and the rest of that. And now, if we do our jobs right, it's actually way, way better. It's denser. It's higher bandwidth. It has the great properties that digital, you know, computational media have. So I want to propose a kind of refinement to your excellent statement a moment ago, which is that we already have that collaborative space, and it is the room. You know, we build interior architectural spaces for ourselves as human beings in a specific way and at a specific scale for a particular reason. We build rooms to accommodate a certain number of people who are going to engage in a in some particular task. So your average meeting room or, you know, workshop room or conference room or whatever you want to call it probably holds 8 to 12 people, because that's how many people you expect to come in and try to work on some problem. Now, for the last 30 years, those people, those 8 to 12 people, have been severely hobbled because all they have is a single display or a projector that's inevitably running PowerPoint. And now you've taken the opportunity to combine the human brains, the minds in the room, and you've turned it into a stultifying broadcast situation, right? Where one person, whoever arm wrestles best and grabs the video cable first and, you know, plugs it into her his laptop is the winner, and now you're treated to 45 minutes of PowerPoint. If, on the other hand, if there were more than one display, if there were lots of pixels, and everyone had access to them so that the interaction could become a dialogue rather than a monologue, you'd be in business. And in fact, that's what we've built. That's what Mezzanine is and does. It is exactly what you described. It screens all over the place that are accessible to all the people in the room that can be, you know, manipulated and added to and inspected and juxtaposed from the devices that people already have, their smartphones and tablets and laptops. So we're running the experiment even as we speak.
So tell me, if you can, can you give me a story about how a company, and you don't have to name names if you're not allowed to, but if you can tell me a story about how somebody's using this in a practical, real-life way?
Sure. Yeah. Well, all right, I've got a good one. We and the other thing that I need to sort of explain to set up the story is that, you know, the Mezzanine system lets you collaborate in the way that you and I have been kind of discussing and working our way toward for these 20 minutes so far in one room. Like, you get a bunch of people into the room, and for the first time, the digital technology actually is sort of an accelerator and an amplifier for what they're trying to do rather than a narrowing. But you can also join, you know, multiple Mezzanine rooms together so that all of the screens are shared between remote sites. And so now your team can literally span geographies and work on the same stuff. And it's not a broadcast model. Everyone still has kind of democratic parallel access to all the pixels. So about 2 years ago, I think, we installed two Mezzanine systems for Beats Music, which has since been acquired, of course, by Apple. But they used this. There was one here in Los Angeles and one up in the Bay Area in San Francisco, I think. And initially, they thought that they were going to, their intent was to use the rooms as a kind of supercharged pitch space, because their business model required, you know, that Ian Rogers, the CEO, get, you know, a bunch of recording artists, Pharrell, whatever, into the room, explain why they should be allowed, why Beats should be allowed to, you know, represent and broadcast their catalog. And so, you know, it was a fantastic pitch space, and that indeed served them very well. But then they sort of expanded the use of the rooms, and they started holding their weekly all-hands meetings in the two rooms connected together so that all the people in the whole company were seeing each other and, you know, working with the pixels and trying out applications live, and everybody was seeing the same thing from Northern California to Southern California. And then they ended up using it in the third big use case, which is sort of distributed collaboration, distributed engineering and design. So, and we do that all the time as well. Our mobile developers are in Barcelona. The rest of us are here in Los Angeles. You connect the two Mezzanine rooms, and you've got the faces, the sort of VTC on, you know, one screen or tucked into a corner of one screen. You've got a couple of different laptops showing their live code all over the place. Then you've got the running prototype of the app, and you're seeing it all side by side. You're seeing it in parallel, the way your human visual system was designed to see, rather than enforcing this weird kind of serial workflow. So the Beats one is a great example, because they began with Mezzanine systems to do one thing, and then they found that it actually applied to every facet of their business, every piece of workflow that they wanted to undertake.
Right, because it's tying in closer to the way humans work. So
yeah, exactly.
That means you can find other ways to make it work.
Yeah.
Well, what are the limitations here? One of your customers in the bio is Boeing. Could I design an airplane on one of these things, or are there still limits to to what this, you know, realistically can do?
Well, we at Oblong, we intend mezzanine and technologies and products like that as a kind of neutral, a new computational medium, but a neutral one, sort of the Switzerland of pixels, with the idea that we're not suggesting that you need to rewrite all of your apps so that they run, your applications so that they run natively in mezzanine. Instead, you know, pixels, live pixels, video, that is the universal interconnect. And so you come into a mezzanine room with your laptop and it's got some kind of you know, bizarre, super specialized CAD system on it. But now all of those pixels from your laptop end up on the big screens, right? So you've taken this kind of private experience and you've made it collaborative. So whatever your devices can already do, and there's a good reason we have these devices. They're powerful, they're personal, they're our second brains. They've got the applications and the data and the interactions and the setup and the configuration that we want. The idea now is to project them into this consensual space, into the space where everyone can see the same thing at the same time. So for Boeing, I mean, one opportunity that this new work style affords is bridging, like using human visual system to bridge software incompatibilities. So what I mean by that is that, you know, at a certain point, Boeing is such a large organization that they're probably using multiple different major releases of a super important, you know, mechanical design or CAD program like CATIA. I'm sort of making this up, but I mean, I know that it is the case as well. And at a certain point, there's a fundamental file format incompatibility between CATIA 4 and CATIA 6, or that I'm totally making up.
Understood.
One way to solve that problem is to get the engineer and the designer who's running CATIA 4 to, you know, to throw those pixels up on one screen next to the bigger workstation that's running CATIA 6, and at least you can now see side by side the two pieces of what you're trying to do. You're building a 787 or whatever it is.
Right. So let me get slightly to a larger scope here for a second, because
sure.
There's something you've said a few times here that are very interesting to me, which is that
Okay. Occasionally
you've said something close to, we're going to take this part of the brain, this visual processing part of the brain or whatever, and we're going to make it work with this part of the computer.
Yeah.
One of the things that I find fascinating about that is I think most people would generally agree with the concept that technology and people aren't working well together at all.
Yes.
So it seems like the key here is that you're talking on a real base level about interacting with human systems and computer systems. Is that a fair way to look at user interface?
It is, and I think in some ways, Oblong is a fairly traditional, maybe even old-fashioned tech company. But I think one thing that's distinctly unusual, and not counting the kind of Minority Report tie-in, is that we start from the premise that building this more powerful, more appropriate, more human UI is not only a valid thing to do, but it's the kind of highest voltage thing that we can possibly do. That by fixating on the UI as the core of the experience, and not thinking like sociologists and psychologists and designers first, more than thinking like computer scientists, is actually an enormous advantage. And you get different kinds of systems, different kinds of computers out of that. And that's the, from my point of view, again, that's the way to take the biggest achievable step forward.
Right. But now let me ask the sort of counter question to that, which
sure.
which is, I guess I sort of set you up, so I apologize if...
Oh no!
Comes off
entrapment.
But it seems like when we actually do make technology more human, it scares the crap out of people. So for instance, your Minority Report. I can't say for sure. I know you did this part of Minority Report.
Yeah.
But people often bring up the part where Tom Cruise walks into a room and it says, you know, "Welcome back, Tom. Did you enjoy those khakis that you
yep.
bought last week?"
Yeah, the Gap scene.
That scares the
Gap.
Crap out of a lot of people, right?
Right.
and so when we do, and I find that electrifying, just like you said, it's an amazing,
yeah.
it's a huge, mind-blowing moment in that movie, really,
yeah.
even though it's so small.
Well, that was supposed to be 50 years in the future, and we barely made it 10 because we have that already, right? The next time
right.
you open your browser, cookies
right.
are going to ensure that if you were looking at a steam injecting bread oven for some reason, you know, last week, you're going to get retargeted ads that show you steam injecting bread ovens, you know, in the middle of technical papers and whatever else you're looking at. So we've
oh,
got
absolutely.
That already.
Right. So where, how do we humanize without sort of demonizing, right? I mean, we have people, very famous, very important people like Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, people like that, worried about artificial intelligence getting too human, right?
People who,
so
frankly, should
make...
know better. People who should know better. It's
that's
a little
how
bit...
I feel too, but...
Strike that. It's not a little bit. It's a lot irresponsible. And either they don't understand where things actually are with AI, or I'm not sure what. I mean, we're not even close. No one is doing actual AI work. People are building, you know, machine learning systems, which are completely different. And the machine learning
right.
systems are gonna give us the gap scenario. That's what's already analyzing, you know, your patterns, your habits, and trying to refine the way we sell to you. That's machine learning.
Right. Okay. So that's
but
that's
strong AI, the really scary stuff, the Skynet stuff, we're I think probably no closer to that than we were, you know, in the late 80s, last time we gave up on AI.
Fair enough. But sometimes it's just the appearance of being human, right? The, you know, they
yeah.
talk about it in
yeah.
robots as the uncanny divide.
Good point.
Right?
Yep.
So how do you create a user interface that's more human, that is more accessible, that is more electric, the way you said, without accidentally scaring the people who are using it?
I have a personal take on that, and maybe it's an aesthetic choice, I don't know, but maybe it's also worth trying in earnest, which is that there's a difference between human and anthropomorphized. There's a big drive toward anthropomorphizing everything, right? Why Siri
right.
gets a name, why it has a particular voice that it does, and so forth. I don't think it's necessary to try to fool people into thinking that they're talking with or looking at or interacting with an actual human. I think, in fact, people are really, really good at dealing with abstractions. And I think non-representational UI can actually be more powerful, you know, than the paperclip that tries to make you think it's a cute and sentient cartoon character. So it is possible to devise new kinds of UI that provide, you know, rich and kind of high bandwidth visual cues without resorting to anthropomorphism. And
right.
I think there's a huge amount of power and opportunity that lies there. And, you know, arguably, people won't be so, you know, creeped out, distracted, annoyed.
Right.
If they're dealing with stuff that's not trying to be something that it isn't, but that is still beautifully designed, that has an aesthetics of its own that maybe gives, you know, through animation, subtle animation, gives a hint of life or kind of activity, but not human life.
Right. So designed for humans, not designed to look human or to
Bingo.
Be human. Oh, okay.
I should have just
that
said
makes sense.
That. I would have saved you and your listeners, you know, 90 seconds of time. Sorry.
I only got there because of what you said. So unfortunately, we're really running out of time.
Sure.
And I feel like we could talk about this all day, and I would love to do that at some point. But let me just ask you two questions. One is sort of a quick, just silly question, and then
yeah.
and then we'll wrap up with the bigger question. So the quick silly question is, how long is it till I have Jarvis and my Iron Man suit? You know, are we going to have those kinds of visual interfaces and sort of be able to have a computer help me build things anytime soon, or are we talking about light years away?
No, I think if the human species is serious about it, we could get there 3, 4, 5 years. Some of the work that's happening at Microsoft on HoloLens or at Magic Leap, along with some really good UI work, could get us there quickly. Because it's not about AI. It's about, you know, a really kind of potent interface, and we can do it if we want to.
Okay, very cool. And now the sort of, you know, serious finishing up question here, and I apologize that this is all we have time for to our listeners, because this has been a great conversation. So let's say I'm a manager or a designer, and I'm hearing this, and I really want to get serious about being better about collaborating, being better about using technology to do more than file swapping and the kind of
yep.
stuff we talked about early on. How can I get more serious? What are the first few kinds of steps I should take besides picking up the phone and calling Oblong and seeing what you've got for sale, which is also something they can do?
You know, well, I think step one is the realization that collaboration in the 21st century is important like it's never been before. People have much more specialized skill sets and jobs, so to get anything done that's bigger than one person implicitly means, you know, effective collaboration. Step two is to observe, really, you know, and observe objectively. How do your teams, how do your spread out teams, your disparate teams work well together? And what are the things that are impeding them? And then, you know, step three is the hardest. Ask if the digital tools that you've deployed into the workplace and for the benefit of your workforce are amplifying what people are doing, or whether they're actually getting in the way. And that's again where you're becoming a bit of a, you know, a bit of a sociologist, a bit of an anthropologist, you know, watching how people work. And then step four is, you know, if the answer is it's not working that well, then I would recommend finding something else to make it work.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being here, John. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's really changed a lot of the way I think about UI and technology in general. Thanks so much.
It's been great. I really appreciate your time and the opportunity.
Great. Well, that was for anybody who just tuned in, John Underkoffler. He's the CEO of Oblong Industries. He's also known as the real Tony Stark. I have to keep saying that because I think it's the most awesome nickname in the entire world. John gave us a fantastic conversation about UI and VR, so please check out the archive if you just tuned in. Our next show is two Wednesdays from now. We will have the CEO of Celery. We'll be talking about changes in crowdsourcing and crowdfunding. He has a lot of really eye-opening things to say about that. I hope you'll tune in for that. We're really looking forward to talking to him. And we hope you have a great day. Thanks for tuning in. We couldn't do this without you. And we'll see you next week.